This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, wow, 2020 is starting off so perfectly for me. I am just having all these wonderful, wonderful guests, and today I am thrilled. I consider these two authors golden threads in my wonderful magic tapestry called Joy on Paper, because there's so many things that connect us. Tasha Alexander and Andrew Grant, they are a team, and it's so wonderful to welcome you to Joy on Paper.
Well, it is always a pleasure to talk to you, Patsy.
Oh.
I've been looking forward to this.
Well, you know,
absolutely. You are way too kind. We're sitting here blushing now, Patsy.
Well, you are really, you know, there are so many little things over the years as I've been doing this program, and you were so kind to be on the fourth anniversary celebration. Just little things that connect me to so many authors. But with you two particularly, it's so funny. With Tasha, of course, it is that I go crazy when I meet anyone who loves the reading room at the British Museum Library, and I know how much it meant to you, Tasha.
Oh, you do.
And then for Drew, because I get to call Andrew Drew because I love him. There are so many things. It's a combination of the fact you're British, and I love people from Britain, so that goes. Then that I know your school, St. Albans, which is so funny because not that many Americans, you know. I lived in England, and I was fortunate I got to visit the school. As a matter of fact, I realized the first time I visited, it was because I was going to Nebworth House.
Yeah, I haven't been to Nebworth House in years. It's a beautiful place, though.
It is. And that's that. I was going up in that direction because I lived over, you know, in Sonning near Henley. And so I would roam around. I would try to, you know, see everything that I could of England. And I was going to Nebworth House, which has fantastic flower shows. It is really one of these places that a lot of Americans don't, you know, it's sort of out of the way and they don't know about it. But to go there, it's really, really magnificent.
It is, and you're right, because there are so many of those country houses. You know, everybody's heard of Chatsworth and places like that, but there are so many it seems unfair to call them the smaller ones, but perhaps the less well-known ones. A bit like Bert and Agnes, remember that one,
absolutely,
Tasha?
That is hands down my favorite country estate in Britain. And I actually based Emily and Colin's house in Derbyshire largely on Bert and Agnes, and that is a house that you go into and it really feels like a home. It doesn't feel like a museum or a castle. It feels like a place that a family has lived for centuries.
Well, that's one of the wonderful things about England. There's so much to see. And as I said, I went to St. Albans, which is, of course, and I had some jokes over the years from friends about dating old Albanians.
Well, you know what? I did, and I highly recommend that.
Yeah, you did a really great job here. And it's of course, it's a fantastic school. In those days, it was for boys. Probably it's integrated now. But anyway, it's a beautiful place, too, and what a wonderful place to get an education. But one of the things that it's funny, another little thread, that a couple months ago I sent you a Nat Geo book.
And yeah,
because I've been very lucky. I get to talk to so many of the Nat Geo photographers and authors because I love Nat. I grew up on Nat Geo books, and so this new book of yours, Tasha, which has a connection to National Geographic, it's so funny. The new book course, it's called In the Shadow of Vesuvius. And I love that little thing with Nat Geo, because people don't realize how old Nat Geo is.
It goes way back, and honestly, I felt like I absolutely had to have it in the book, because my interest in Pompeii and Herculaneum came from reading an issue of National Geographic when I was a little girl, and it was one of them that talked about Pompeii, and I was just captivated by it. So I felt like I had to give the magazine a nod somehow in the book.
Well, I think it's wonderful. It's just perfect. And as I said, I love Nat Geo. Now, you were raised with a family of, intellectuals and with books and things. Now, I was very poor. I was raised in northern Michigan. We didn't have a lot of, resources. But the one thing we always managed to do, somehow we always managed to keep that subscription to National Geographic coming. And that was my window to the world. And that's really one of the reasons that I became such a, world traveler is because of National Geographic. And I'm trying now with all of the interviews I do, I try to promote that everyone should just make visiting people should be a Nat Geo opportunity, because they make the best gifts.
Oh, they do.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean about it being a window in the world and inspiring travel, because when I was a kid, it was actually before we'd moved to St. Albans, when I was still living in Birmingham. I was the surprise addition to the family 10 years after my previous brother. And so I had a tiny little room. It was kind of the old box room in the house, because they'd never expected to need another bedroom. And the one thing on the wall, there was a magazine. I don't know if it still exists, but so when I was a kid growing up, there was a magazine in England called Look and Learn, and they produced this map of, I don't think it was necessarily the official Seven Wonders of the World, but it was kind of their version. And I remember lying in bed every night going to sleep looking at this map and imagining going to all the places. And in particular, I remember there was a picture of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And, I'm a very sort of ordered, organized person. I like things neat. I like right angles. I like everything organized. So even as a little kid looking at this tower that was all crooked and bent and thinking that, wow, people don't mind it being that way. This must be something amazing. And it took a few years, but I finally got there. And I remember being really nervous approaching it, because, when something's built up in your mind for so long and, you're desperate for it to live up to your idea, and I had this sudden worry, what if it isn't really leaning all that much? What if you have to sort of stand there and convince yourself that, maybe it's not quite straight? But of course, when you go there, that thing, you can't believe how it hasn't fallen over.
I know, it's wonderful. Well, Tasha, the new book is so wonderful on so many levels. Again, for me, In the Shadow of Vesuvius. I also love Pompeii. It is one of the places that I went on one of my three honeymoons. I think it was honeymoon number two. Yeah. That's the one where my husband and I drove through Europe. We went down from Rome over to Naples, and then we went on. We did the entire Appian Way. We went to Brindisi and took.
Oh, how wonderful!
And we did the entire road, and we took a ferry from there to Turkey, or to Greece. And so it's just for me, it's a wonderful reminder. So just tell us about this wonderful story that you came out with. It's very clever. And of course, we've got Lady Emily, and we have all of the people around her. So many of my favorite characters. I love Colin, but I must say I have this really penchant for Jeremy. So tell us about the new book.
Well, a lot of people have a real penchant for Jeremy, so you are not alone. And I will say he is one of the funnest characters to write. I had, from the very beginning, wanted to see Emily in Pompeii, and partly just because it truly is like no other place on Earth. It is a place where, if you kind of take all of the ruins from Vesuvius, so you've got Pompeii and Herculaneum and their villas at Apollontis, you really can feel like you are walking through an ancient city. You are walking on the paving stones. You can go into the houses. The walls are still upright. You can really get a sense of what it was like to live in the ancient world. And going again back to when I was a little girl, you know, I always loved history and I was always fascinated by the past, but it used to really bug me that you couldn't really feel what it was like to live in the past. And I think Pompeii gives us a closer feeling than any place else in the world to what that was probably like. So, and it's also a natural for Emily, obviously, with her love of the classical world. The other thing is I really enjoy having two timelines in books. That's what I like to read. And so if you like to read it, it makes sense to write things that you would like to read, right? And I've long wanted to write about a woman in the ancient world. Because, and I think, Patsy, we've talked about this many, many times, people have this idea that history, all of history, but particularly when you look at the role of women and their rights and how they're treated, people tend to think there's sort of been this linear progression marching along the centuries and that it gets better and better and we get women are better off as you get closer to the contemporary world. And that's not really true. You know, you have rights go up and down and things that are better for women and worse for women throughout time. And ancient Rome, in a lot of ways, sure, women, you know, weren't directly involved in politics. They couldn't be a senator, for example. But they were really running a lot of the show. And the wives of powerful men in the Roman Empire were enormously influential. So that fascinates me. But what also fascinates me about ancient Rome is that you have, as with all ancient societies, a lot of slavery. These civilizations run because of slaves. But in Rome, there was a clear path for a slave to become a full citizen, full Roman citizen. And it didn't matter whether you're a man or a woman. And I wanted to write about someone who had been a slave, because the ancient experience of slavery is so different from what we're used to, particularly from 19th century America.
Well, it's just perfect. I love, as you said, you have this the two stories running, and I always enjoy that so much because I like to go back in time. I like to see where, you know, where things come from. And when we're talking about Vesuvius, of course, wow, it's still so amazing. People, like, you know, we just had this volcano, and people recently where people are injured. It happens so fast.
It does.
It can happen so fast, and we look back and we say, well, how could it happen so fast? How could all those people be there? How could they get trapped? And yet we saw just recently in this recent, it was a small volcano, so it's nothing, you know, nothing major, but it can happen so very fast.
It really can. And one of the things when I was starting research on Vesuvius, I just had assumed that the people living around it knew it was a volcano, but the Romans did not know Vesuvius was a volcano. It had not erupted for so many centuries that they had no concept that they were living, you know, miles from something that was going to destroy everything. Because I kept thinking, why do they live there? But they didn't know. Now we know, and people,
and there's still
millions
there.
Of people live there now.
Oh, it's when sometimes it's really frightening when you look and you see the number of homes.
Oh, it is. And the thing with Vesuvius, I mean, you know, it's very difficult to try to predict how any volcano is going to behave, and volcanologists are really good at monitoring, and then they can get a sense of what's going on. But they know that volcano is going to erupt again. How are you going to evacuate the millions of people who live on the Bay of Naples?
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen at all. And, of course, your story here where you have Cassandra, where we a poet, a girl who really has a yearning to share beauty and to share her thoughts. And then of course we have Lady Emily coming along. Now the year is 1902, and discovering so much about Pompeii.
Yeah, and you know it was really fun writing this book. And like I said, I love doing the two timelines. But I will say with this one, I had no idea how the two stories were going to come together until I was writing that denouement scene.
Wow.
And it just, honestly, as I was writing it, it gave me chills when I realized, oh my gosh, of course, this is how these two women centuries apart come together.
Now, of course, it's always so wonderful to think of the two of you writing, sort of, you do the book a year, so your year is really busy.
It is.
Exactly. If we're not reading something, we're writing something. There's no in between.
That's true.
So while you're deep in now, of course, you visited there.
I did. And I have to say, you know, so many people do visit Pompeii, but if you can take more than a day there, oh my goodness, you have to go to Herculaneum. You have to go see the Imperial Villa at Apollontis. I was in Pompeii long enough that I really felt like I knew the city by, you know, the thing is, it's so overwhelming. You know, you've got the plaster casts of the bodies. You've got just such a sense of immense loss through that entire site. I was with my son and two friends of ours. It took us about 3 days in the ruins before we even felt like we could speak adequately about it because it was so overwhelming.
It is. Until you experience it, you don't realize the enormity of it and the beauty that was there.
Yeah.
Wow, it's fantastic. And I love everything you do with Lady Emily in the story. And there are a lot of twists and turns in this story. A couple of really surprising things, which, of course, makes all of your readers so happy. Because not only do we have some of the old friends and people connected with Emily and Colin, but a new arrival that comes as a bit of a shock.
Yes. And, you know, that came as a shock to me, too.
Well, that's always fun. It's always fun that you can bring in something fresh and new and that readers will say, "Woo, I like this. This is a new angle." And of course, while you're doing that and I don't know how the two of you work in your two little in your spaces out there, you know, and you're in one world. And then, of course, wow, Drew, you're in another world.
Absolutely. You know, and for the first time, I think, with this book, I felt a bit more of an understanding of what Tasha does with her research, because I wasn't going as far back into the past as she does, but there are a couple of sections of this book that go back to the kind of 70s and 80s. So even that kind of distance, you have to remind yourself, well, what was going on then? What kind of technology did people have? You know, what were the concerns of the day? What were people worried about? You know, so it was very fun. I mean, you know, the danger that I really understand now is that once you delve into these other worlds, you just kind of want to stay there. You just keep thinking, well, I'll just read one more research book. You know, that'll be fine. but then before you know it, that deadline is looming, so you've got to get back down to work.
Well, the new book is called Too Close to Home, and it is the second of your Paul McGrath series, in which we are, now we know that he is a janitor and, you know, living a secret life, and quite a fascinating character that you've developed here. And Tasha had some twists and turns, but you have a major twist that I did not expect at the end.
I will tell you, because I was the first person who read this book, and I literally gasped out loud when I got to that bit.
I know. I was startled, and I said, "Oh, that's so clever," and then I would say, "Oh, I love it." And, you know, it was fantastic.
Well, that's so good to hear, because, you know, because that's exactly what you want to hear as a writer. Because the thing is, if you know yourself, so it's not a surprise to you. So, you know, but you want to present it in a way that it will catch people in that way, and that it will produce that kind of reaction. So, I'm delighted to hear that you like that part, because, you know, that was a very fun thing to construct. So, I really enjoyed doing it.
These are the things that are so hard to talk about because you don't want to say what it is because it ruins the surprise for everyone else.
Exactly. I never tell anybody because I say you just have, just enjoy the process. The build up, the better the author, and the two of you are both so good, the better the payoff, because you just build it up and build it up, and then we get these wonderful twists and wonderful new things that make us feel fresh and that, wow, you know, it sort of makes us sit up and take notice, and it's, I love it.
You know, and it's really fun to do, but like you say, it's something you've got to be so careful with because, you know, every author, before they start writing, they are a reader. So everyone knows the kind of things that they individually like to read and what makes them feel good about a book and what makes them feel bad about a book. And for me, you know, the big danger is that if you put in a twist or a turn or a reveal purely for the sake of it, if I'm reading a book like that, you know, you don't feel good about it. You feel almost a little bit cheated, you know. So I think any kind of a big twist or reveal that you have in there, it has to be really part of the story. You have to look at it and feel like it was there from the beginning. It wasn't something that was just bolted on at the end for effect. So what I try to do always is work very hard to ensure that anything that that you come across, any little nuggets that you dig up as you're going along, people think, oh yeah, that was in the ground right from day one. And even if you hadn't seen the signs, and even if you hadn't noticed initially, when you look back, you think, yeah, fair enough. You know, there were clues that show that this was coming, rather than it just being completely out of the blue.
Exactly. Now normally I take commercials. I'm not going to actually do a commercial today. I'm just going to thank Larson & Larson, Bill Larson of Larson & Larson. He is our intellectual property lawyer. He comes onto the program once a month to answer all of the listeners' questions about intellectual property, how to protect themselves, and about all the problems that can happen to an author. And take it from me, I know what problems can arise, and even famous authors, very famous authors like Clive Cussler, have had, you know, $10 million lawsuits. So anybody who is a writer should have a great intellectual property lawyer, and Bill Larson is that. And then also I want to thank Glenn L. Erickson, because he is someone who supports Joy on Paper, and every month he gets on the program and talks and tries to help authors. But I am going to play one of our book buzzes. As you know, I like to do these book buzzes, and I'm going to play one now for a book that I'm sure you've read and heard about, and the authors love you. So that's why I'm playing this book buzz, okay? So hold on and just listen.
This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz. It's strike and counterstrike as John Dempsey takes the fight to the Russians in Red Spectre by best-selling authors Brian Andrews and Jeffrey Wilson. Here's the buzz. When shadow warrior and former Tier 1 Navy SEAL John Dempsey goes undercover to meet with an arms dealer, he thinks he's laying the groundwork to penetrate the Russian criminal underground. Instead, he walks into a trap orchestrated by Zeta, the secret Russian task force behind a recent assassination attempt on the U.S. president. For Dempsey and the team, the only way out is to lay waste to the Russians, putting a target on Ember's back, America's premier black ops task force. With Dempsey pitted against Zeta, a dangerous game of strike and counter-strike ensues, sanctioned in the halls of the Kremlin and the White House, but disavowed to the world. As the line between espionage, counterterrorism, and special ops blurs, Ember is ordered to eliminate their ultimate adversary, which means taking the fight against Zeta to the Russian soil. But like a phoenix risen from the Cold War embers, Zeta is more capable than anyone imagines, and the Russians retaliate with an operation that will find Dempsey and Ember battling for survival. Red Spectre is the fifth novel in the exciting Tier 1 thriller series by Wall Street Journal best-selling authors Brian Andrews, a U.S. Navy veteran and former submarine officer, and Wall Street Journal best-selling author Jeffrey Wilson, a U.S. Navy combat vascular and trauma surgeon making multiple deployments with an East Coast-based SEAL team. It goes without saying that these two authors really know what they are writing about. Thank you, gentlemen, for your service.
For more of my suggestions on the books you should not miss, go to our webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and click on Book Buzz. That's radio-joyonpaper. Rita Moreau, buzzing off for now.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know, as you know, we do these book buzzes because we like to continue promoting authors' books long after the release date.
Well, that is a tremendous thing, Patsy. I wish more people would do it.
Yes.
well, you know, we have book buzzes for you guys, both of you, and I play them, you know, whenever I have an extra minute or two, I play them because this is important. Authors have these exciting release dates. It's so exciting that both of you are having your release day on the same, you know, same date. But then after that, it's difficult to get coverage. It's difficult. And people might say, well, I remember someone was talking about a book, and then they forget. And
yeah.
So that's why we do this. We do that, you know, and Rita Moreau is just wonderful. She loves to do these. And it was funny when Brian and Jeff were here, Brian was talking about you, Andrew, because, you know, he was saying, oh, Andrew Grant's a great author. I said, I know that.
That's well, it was very nice of him to say. I'm flattered.
Well,
praise coming from a guy like that, that is wonderful.
Oh, he is so sweet. He's absolutely adorable. And, you know, I was so happy that I got to meet you again in BoucherCon in Dallas. And that was a real thrill. And you were, of course, on a panel, the espionage panel, which is just the perfect panel for you, I think.
It was very good. I really enjoyed it, yeah.
And, of course, one of the people there was Alistair Kimball.
Yep, that's right.
Oh, he's wonderful.
And he was on the program about a month or so ago. What a guy. I had so much fun talking to him. He was absolutely delightful.
He is. He's one of those guys. Not only does he know his stuff, but he when he talks about it, it's serious, but it's hilarious at the same time. He's wonderful to talk to.
Oh, he's just fantastic. I was so thrilled to get to meet him at BoucherCon. And again, BoucherCon, it is such a wonderful, wonderful place to go for authors. I was so, as when you were here in the one here in St. Petersburg 2 years ago, it was really wonderful. It was my first chance to meet fans, to see the importance of authors to fans. They just love you guys.
It's an amazing conference because, you know, especially when you're a writer, you work alone. You're isolated a lot of the time. You're living in your head when you're working. And it's so nice to get to interact with readers and see the life that your book takes on in their minds and what it means to them. There's nothing better.
And I think it's great the way that it's in a different city every year because, you know, for a lot of people, if you have to take the amount of time off work and travel across the country, you know, it can be a big commitment. And so, you know, because some conferences are always in the same location, which means a lot of people can't get to them. And it was great. I mean, I'd only been to Dallas once before, so this year it was great to meet people. It's so touching because, you know, people had copies of right back to my first book, and you know, I hadn't seen that book in the wild for years. It was lovely to meet people that hadn't had the chance to come out to any conferences or any events like that for a while. So, you know, I think they do a great job in that way too.
Well, it's so important to them. There were people there who you know, when they tell me, I really feel like I'm this author, whoever they were talking about, they'd say, you know, this author really has connected with me, and I look forward to reading the books, and I reread, you know, many times people would say I reread these books because the characters become friends. They care about them.
Yes.
They do. That's the ideal, isn't it? That they see the characters as their friends, and they look forward to their kind of annual visit with them to see, you know, see what they're up to, see how they're doing. So, I remember that as a reader myself. You know, you'd just be so excited looking forward to the next edition of your favorite series.
Now, you know, one of the things is last time I had the my listeners ask a lot of questions. And over the past year, I've really had an opportunity to talk to more authors who are just starting off. And for both of you, of course, you have been readers all of your lives. And this is important because really I discovered so many people who want to write and dream about writing, and they start writing, but they don't have the background. Now, I'm self-taught. I just read because that's what I just started reading, like Beatrix Potter at the age of two. I was reading, and I never even looked back. That was my life, just reading.
That's exactly how I was. You know, because my parents, they didn't have a ton of money, and so the library, that was everything. The library can take you everywhere in the world.
Exactly. And that's what I tell people, that they really have to read more and read better. Now, Andrew, of course, you went to a very, very fine school. So, I mean, that helps. You know, it really gives you a solid foundation. What were you like as a kid in school?
Well, I think that would depend on who you ask. I would say that I was very reasonable, very well behaved.
I'm thinking about some of the stories I've heard and not quite seeing how those mesh up with what you're saying right now.
Well, you know, what is it you have in the States? The Fifth Amendment. I think I might have to invoke that in this situation. But you know, I think the thing for me was that, and this is really why I liked English literature so much when I was at school, and why I really appreciate the school that I went to, because they were all about presenting you with wonderful things to read and then encouraging you to make up your own mind about them, to think about them critically, and to feel the freedom to express whatever opinion you had. You know, it could be outrageous, it could be crazy, but as long as you could justify it, you know, you couldn't just throw out any old nonsense. You have to be able to say why that was. You felt at the same time you felt that your mind was getting better at homing in on the small details to give you the ammunition to build the case you wanted to make, but at the same time broadening your horizons, because you'd read more things in different genres by different people from different countries, and that you could see the kind of these small details combining, like joining the dots in a big picture, to be able to see how everything in life fitted together and how different points of view could not only disagree with one another but also sometimes complement one another. So I think the one thing from my school days that I appreciate the most is those teachers, those English teachers that I had, who would just encourage you to read everything, think about everything, and not be constrained in the way that you think. You know, if something strikes you in a particular way, your view is just as relevant and just as right as anybody else's.
Well, I love Paul McGrath. You know, now of course he's American, but I do love all the little touches of England that you throw in there every once in a while, like bespoke.
Yeah.
And and soccer hooligans.
Oh yeah.
Oh, that was good. Yes, I said, okay, soccer hooligans. I know that one. I didn't know. Were they always like that when you were young? Were those hooligans?
They were worse when I was young. Yeah, I mean, nowadays it's it's tame, really. You know, when I was a kid, if you wanted to go to a soccer match, you know, I mean, even now you got to think about it a little, you know, to some extent. But you'd have to think ahead. You'd have to work out which route you would take to get to the ground, because you couldn't stray into the wrong area. If you wanted to go to the pub beforehand, you had to be absolutely sure that you were going to the right pub, because if you went to the wrong one, it would be terrible. And you know, it was, you know, back to the days, there was a horrendous disaster at a football ground in I think 1989, which led to a rethink of how the stadia were organized. But before that, the fans were literally in pens. They were in cages to prevent them from getting into the area where the opposing fans were. And, you know, that was in the ground. Once you were outside, you know, there would be a huge police presence every time, but they couldn't control everyone. So, you know, you really had to be careful in those days. It's a lot more reasonable now.
Well, next time you go back, if you ever happen to be just walking along and meet Harry Kane,
I'll give him your number, don't worry.
Oh, yes. I'm hoping he'll write a book. He should write a book. I want him to write a book. He could write a mystery. He could write a history. I don't care what he writes, anything. And he can be on Joy on Paper. I'm a little obsessed with Harry Kane.
Maybe you could have him on to talk about what books he likes to read.
Yeah, it's a good idea. That's it. Get me a connection to him. Oh, that, I will do it, and I'll give him the whole hour, because I just, you know, the funny thing is I have, know nothing about American football. It's just so funny.
I feel you. I live in a sports-free environment. I was born without the sports gene.
Yeah, other than Harry Kane and soccer, you know, that's about it for me. And so it's just, I enjoy that. I love all those little things that you have in your book. And of course, for you, you know, for Tasha, you also sort of give a nod to Elizabeth Peters. And
yeah.
And I like the one in this book, to Margaret George of the Pearl, you know, Cleopatra and the feeding of the Pearl.
Yeah, well, Margaret George is such a phenomenal writer. She is just absolutely one of my favorites. In fact, one of the greatest moments of my entire life, I was doing an event in Madison, Wisconsin, and she came to it. And I will tell you what, I was basically incoherent the entire event, because I just kept saying, oh my God, Margaret George is in this room. She's just extraordinary.
She is. She's delightful. She invited me actually to her home in Madison, and I went and I got to meet her tortoise, Troilus.
Oh, how wonderful.
You know, and Troilus is 55 years old.
Yeah.
And so it was quite a thrill. It was last winter and it was snowing and there's snow on the ground. And so I said, where's Troilus? Where's Troilus? And there he is in his little place behind the sofa. And it was so wonderful. And of course, you know, when you look at what she's done.
Yeah.
And her books, and I pick up her books every once in a while, just because you need to have that really great writing in your head, you know?
Yes.
And so I pick up like Henry VIII, and then I, of course, we were talking about her one day, and she said, you know, she wrote it all by hand.
You know, yeah.
800.
No, she's amazing. She's one of those people who is just so profoundly talented. She has such a grasp of the history, and she understands how to use primary sources, and she's able to take everything, get it into her brain, and then it pours out in the most wonderful, wonderful novels. Her Memoirs of Cleopatra, that's a book I go back and read.
Oh, I know. It's fantastic. And again, written by her, and she has them. I said to you, what do you do with them? Where are they? She said, they're up in the attic. And I said, you have to get them down and preserve them, because you want to donate them someday, you know, to some graduate student will be doing, you know, a report about you, doing their thesis, and to have the original work in handwriting is fantastic. Because I don't know, you both use computers?
I do. I couldn't write longhand at a speed that would be even semi-reasonable.
Although you do have a whole catalog of handwritten notebooks.
Oh, I do.
When you're doing
your
research, so
yeah.
I think those could be pretty fascinating one day.
Let's burn them.
No, oh, don't you dare. Don't ever say that. No, that has to go to some university. Because think of that. You will make some graduate student very happy. And that's how you have to look at preserving your work.
That you're right. But, you know, it's such an odd thing because you just feel so, like, you feel so... Like, why would anyone want to look at your own thing, you know?
Oh, they do. They do. And it will give them a really original thesis because so many of them have done F. Scott Fitzgerald. They cannot do one more F. Scott Fitzgerald. I think there are 30,000.
Yeah, no, you're right.
30,000, you know, theses done on PhDs gotten on poor F. Scott Fitzgerald. That's enough. They need to do it on other people. So, yeah, preserve all your notes and give them to your school because that's definitely something that that I think it is. Again, it's part of what I talk to writers about. You learn.
You do.
Every time you write, every time you start, of course, the first time when you start writing, it's not perfect. Even with the great education like that both of you have had, I'm sure there were times where you wrote things and they had to be edited and you re-edited and done, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because you always, part of the process is you have to have a desire to always try to be better than you were before, and you can't do that on your own. You know, you need an editor who's on the same wavelength as you to be able to to help you to get it to that next level. And if you're not open minded in that way, then I think that you're gonna struggle to progress, really. But the other thing that's kind of I find anyway, I don't know if anyone else would find this, but for me, I read this cliche years ago, and it's so true: is that you only ever learn how to write the book that you just finished writing. Every time you sit down to start the next book, it's just as difficult as it was in the beginning because it's a new book and it has different demands and it's going to go in a different direction. And, it used to frustrate me because I'd think, I've written 5 books now. Surely I should be able to, the next one should be easier. But no, it wasn't. And then you're thinking, well, I've written 6 books now. Surely the next one should be easier. And it wasn't, and so on. And, I've come to just to almost welcome that now because... Tasha and I have both said over the years that a lot of the time, if you back yourself into a corner, if you write yourself into a corner, that's when you have to do your best work because you have to be more creative and more imaginative to get out of it. So if you feel that from the beginning, then you know that you're challenging yourself and hopefully stretching yourself and trying to do better work than you've done before.
So I assume that when you guys finish a book, you are like each other's first readers?
Yes.
We are.
Yeah. Wow, that must be an exciting moment.
It is. It's really nice. Because, there's really nothing more stressful than knowing that someone is reading your book because, you're pouring yourself out onto the page. And, people, obviously, if you've written a bunch of books, your readers are going to love some of them, not love some of them. You hope they don't hate some of them. But, it's... You're in a vulnerable position when you let that book go out into the world and you don't know what people are going to think about it.
Yeah, what's that quote you had from David Mitchell?
Oh, yeah, it's when... it's actually theoretically about a poem, but it could be the same. It's something... actually, if you give me 2 seconds, I could try to find it. But basically, he says, when a poem leaves home, it's no longer yours and doesn't care about you anymore. And, that's really true.
Well, I was thinking more of that coffin thing.
Oh, that one. That's actually, that's my, So, yes, this is in his book, Black Swan Green, which is about a 13-year-old boy living in Thatcher's Britain during the Falkland War. And this little boy likes to write poems, and he is taking one, or a group of them, I can't remember if it's a collection, to be read by the person who edits the parish newsletter, which has published him. And In fact, when I first met Andrew, this is one of the first things we talked about. But what the little boy says is, and I'm like trying to flip, I have a notebook right next to me on my table in my office where I write down sentences and passages from books that I like. But I'm not going to sit here and make you wait for me to read, find it and read it directly. But basically what Mitchell says is, when you give someone something you've written to read, you hand them a steak, lie in your coffin, and say, when you are ready. Because that's what it feels like. You're just waiting for the steak through your heart.
You are. But that's why it makes it so much nicer to have somebody that you trust and that you know so well to be your first reader.
Exactly. So. Because you think is what you need is you don't want someone who's just going to say, oh, my gosh, yes, everything you do is brilliant. Because that's not helpful. Because nothing that anyone does is always brilliant. And you need somebody who's going to be really honest about the good and the bad.
Mm-hmm. And I always find, anyway, that at the end of a manuscript, as I'm approaching the end, I get such a sort of, I get into this tunnel vision mode where I really do nothing, you know, I probably eat and drink coffee, but apart from that, I do nothing but write. And that means that you do get the job done, but you are so close to the manuscript that you have no idea whether it's any good or not, or whether it's just going to be the end of you. So
yeah.
Having somebody that you can give it to who can read it before you email it off is really, really valuable.
Wow. Well, you guys are just, so wonderful. And it's always a thrill for me, you know, to talk to you. And now I know that you're already working, I'm sure, on your next books.
Absolutely, yeah. But you know, what I, you know, I had this idea for the janitor to introduce him in the first in the series Invisible, which introduced not only him but also some of his family situation and his kind of moral compass that leads him to confront anything that he sees as being wrong or unjust. So that. His sort of moral crusade has continued into the second book, where we learn more about his family background, and that sort of left us in a position where we realize there's more that we need to know about that family background. So that's
definitely
that I'm going to be exploring in the third one,
especially after that last twist. Now,
oh yeah, but I have to say about the janitor books too. I think they are just truly phenomenal. They are extraordinary, and Andrew is so good at writing a plot that just propels you through the book, but he's just brilliant with wit. There is so much wit in these books.
Yes.
Well, that's very nice of you to say, sweetheart. I really appreciate it.
I mean, I'm thinking about that bit where, you know, the janitor may or may not be having to fling someone off of a roof. And he has cones set up blocking off the space below the roof.
Oh, I love
it. Because he doesn't want to hurt anyone else except the bad guy.
Yeah, I thought that was... that's the British touch. So
it is. It is. It absolutely is.
Absolutely. Well, Natasha, you have a beautiful website.
Oh, thank you.
Was that a photo? Did you take that photo?
I actually designed the website myself.
Wow, it's really great. It's really great. And people can go to your website. It's TashaAlexander.com. And you have also a newsletter that you issue, what, on the Ides of every month?
I do. I have to confess that some months I fall behind, but my goal is to have a newsletter on the Ides of every month.
And I like your little blurb there, Master of Packing Light.
I am very good at it.
Me too.
I once went to Europe for 9 weeks with one carry-on.
I did it for years. That's all I always just wanted to have a little bit of extra energy and space for a few books. The
yes.
books were the important thing.
Yeah.
Everything else could be a nice sweater, a couple of scarves. That could take care of everything.
Exactly.
It was having enough space for books. So I love that. And so it's TashaAlexander.com. And, of course, Andrew, and the new book is In the Shadow of Vesuvius, and it's available wherever books are sold. And, Andrew, you have a website, too?
I do. My one is andrewgrantbooks.com.
Yes.
because I was born with a much more common name. So, yeah, I couldn't just have andrewgrant.com. So mine is andrewgrantbooks.com.
And the new book is Too Close to Home, and people can find out more about you there. And I think one of the things that people might want to keep in mind is that Andrew was the leader of the espionage panel at BoucherCon. So I think perhaps he knows what he writes. So we can say that. And I think that you guys are just wonderful. And again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's always a joy for me to talk to both of you.
Oh, well, it is an absolute pleasure, as always. We love getting to talk to you, Patsy.
We really do. Thank you so much for taking the time to have us on the show and for coming up with such good and interesting questions. Thank you.
Yeah, and for what all you do for the world of readers. You know, your support makes a big difference to authors, and I just love that you are getting books to readers.
Okay, thank you. And bye-bye now, okay?
All right, take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Absolutely. Oh, well, they are fantastic. What a couple. This is when we're talking power couple. We are talking power couple. My goodness, they are really quite amazing and wonderful authors. Both of their new books are just fascinating. As I said, I just loved when my husband and I were in Pompeii. It's until you go there, you cannot imagine what it is like to walk around there. And I hope that if you're looking for a trip, I think that's one of the nicest trips that you can make in Europe nowadays. The cities are very crowded. It's not as much fun to be in Paris or even in Rome. But certainly Naples is still charming, and all of the area around there, the Bay of Naples, of course, Pompeii. And if you can continue on down the Appian Way a little ways, it's hundreds of miles, but take the first few, you know, first 50 miles, and it's so fascinating. And one of the books that I recommend is Robert Castor's The Appian Way. It is a wonderful book. It tells you everything you need to know about the Appian Way, and I suggest that you get that. And meanwhile, go ahead and get this In the Shadow of Vesuvius, Tasha Alexander. It will put you in the mood to be there. And of course, with Andrew Grant, what can I say? He's just so wonderful. And it was always so much fun. He stood out there at BoucherCon because he's 6'7" or something like that. Anyway, again, remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very lucky, to hear those words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing. So this is the beginning of the year. You have an opportunity to start a page a day, and in the year, at the end of the year, you're going to have a novel. Think of that, a novel in 1 year. All you have to do is start writing. Say something nice to somebody today. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year to everyone. Bye-bye now. Oh, and he's saluting me, and I salute you. Bye.